So, are we live, is the question.
Are we getting on the notification yet?
Getting there's myself right there. Say hi.
Tell yourself to say hi to yourself.
Yeah.
Say hi to yourself.
We're at least live there. Let's see. What about Facebook? Of course, I closed it. Still not liking. We're still not on YouTube, are we?
Not yet.
And
is there a delay built into those?
So, Eli, tell everybody to go to GraceLifeBibleChurch.com and click on live stream at the top. I don't understand. I'm still going to have to take this home and investigate it. This should be allowing me to go to multiple platforms at the same time, and it doesn't seem to be doing that. So we're going to have to do some investigation into why that's the case. Okay, well, now for sure, this was going to be a stretch to get through all this to start with. Now for sure, I'm not going to get through all of it. So let's start here, okay? Good morning. Sorry we're late. I think I might know what the problem is, but I'm not sure. I'm going to take the equipment home and try to figure it out this week. So everybody should have in front of them a set of notes for lesson 259, assessing the printed history of the King James text, Scrivener on the Italics. If you're joining us right now on the church's website and you want to follow along, go to GraceLifeBibleChurch.com. Click on lesson 259 under recent sermons, and that's not working either. It is cooked. Just keeps, I must have uploaded the wrong thing. Okay, so we're going to go with this. I do know what I'm doing most of the time, first, in case you guys are wondering, but anyway. All right. Lesson 259, Assessing the Printed History of the King James Text, Scrivener on the Italics, Introduction. In Lesson 258, we began looking at what F.H.A. Scrivener had to say about the use of italics in the Authorized Version. The lesson discussed contemporary scholarly views on the practice. Specifically, we looked at what Norton and Campbell said and began examining Scrivener's systematic analysis of the italics in the Authorized Version in his book, Authorized Edition of the King James Bible, 1611, and that was published in 1910, okay? So all told, in Lesson 258, we considered the following points. Number one, we looked at the scholarly debate regarding the continued usefulness of italics in modern editions of the King James Bible. You remember that we saw that, particularly David Norton said that the use of italics has changed, that italics used to be to de-emphasize something, but now it's used to emphasize something. Secondly, we saw F.H.A. Scrivener's analyzing categories divide the use of italics into six different classes. And then we looked at the first class of italics use identified by Scrivener, and that was to harmonize parallel passages. Okay, so in this lesson, we want to continue to look at Scrivener's six classes. So, Scrivener on the Italics, halfway down page one. In appendix two of his recently published book, The Text of the King James Bible, that was this year, 2025, Dr. Lawrence M. Vance deals with the subject matter of italics in the text of the AV. In the context, Vance is discussing the use of italics in 1 John 2, verse 23, when he stated that F.H.A. Scrivener is the only writer to offer a systematic analysis of the italics in the Authorized Version. Quote, this is from page 457, he says, "The only detailed analysis of the italic type in the King James Bible is that of Scrivener in the Authorized Edition of the English Bible, 1611. He identified six reasons why the translators of the Authorized Version and its subsequent editors used italic type." And so let's just quickly review class one. Now, I put this in here. I don't have all the screenshots. Those are all in the previous lesson if you want to look at those again. But I want to refresh your memory on this because it has been a week since we looked at this. So class one, Scrivener's first class is stated as follows. Quote, page 64, "When words quite or nearly necessary to complete the sense of the sacred writers have been introduced into the text from parallel places of Scripture." So to illustrate this class, Scrivener provided pairs of verses from 2 Samuel and 1 Chronicles, respectively. Screenshots of these examples are provided in Lesson 258. So let's just look at them again, okay? Briefly, going through this fairly quick. So 2 Samuel 5, 8, we're talking about this phrase right here in italics, "He shall be chief and captain." Remember last week in Lesson 258, we actually went to Blue Letter Bible and I showed you how those words are in brackets and they're not there, okay? So have them underlined, and then the corresponding verse. So this, there's no Hebrew words corresponding to "he be chief and captain" in 2 Samuel 5:8. But in a parallel passage in 1 Chronicles chapter 11, verse 6, notice this. "And David said, whosoever smiteth the Jebusites first shall be chief and captain." And notice that in 1 Chronicles 11, 6, it's not in italics. I've underlined it here in the notes so that you can, so it stands out for comparison purposes, but it's not in 2 Samuel 5, 8, so the translators provide italics. The phrase is in 1 Chronicles 11, 6. It's not in italics. I have them underlined in both spots in the notes so it stands out to you, okay? So Scrivener's first class of italics is when words are provided that are not in the Hebrew or Greek, but are in a verse in a parallel passage. Okay? Now, hopefully you guys remember that from last week. Are we pretty clear on that, hopefully? Okay, so then the rest of the examples are as follows. We've got 2 Samuel 6, 6. Here, his hand is in italics. The corresponding cross-reference is in 1 Chronicles 13, 9. His hand is not in italics. Okay? So they're adding his hand to 2 Samuel 6, 6, putting it in italics to have it correspond with 1 Chronicles 13, 9. The next example is 2 Samuel 8, 4. "And David took from him 1,000 chariots." Chariots is the italicized word in 2 Samuel 8, 4. In 1 Chronicles 18, 4, "And David took from him 1,000 chariots." Chariots is not in italics in that verse. So again, Scrivener is saying that the translators are adding chariots in italics in 2 Samuel 8, 4 to make it match nice with the parallel passage or the cross-reference. Okay, 2 Samuel 8, 18, "And Benaniah, the son of Jehoiada, was over." Okay, so "was over" is added here in 2 Samuel 8:18. It's in italics. It's in the text in 1 Chronicles 18:17, and so therefore it's not in italics in that verse in the King James Bible. 2 Samuel 21:19, dealing with Goliath. So in 2 Samuel, you'll notice these words are added, "slew the brother of Goliath, the Gittite, and then the corresponding cross-reference in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, "and slew Lemuel, the brother of Goliath, the Gittite." So here in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, it's not in italics. They added italics here to make those parallel passages match.
So in this case where there's the italics and then it's not, where there's the italics, I mean, there was just nothing there.
There's no Hebrew corresponding words.
So like when they were translating, so when they came to that area, there was just nothing there?
There's no Hebrew words to correspond. So in this,
so you read it without it.
In 2 Samuel 21:19, the Hebrew words for brother of are not in the Hebrew text at this verse.
So it said a Bethlehemite slew Goliath the Gittite.
That's what it would have said.
Okay, so then they.
Okay.
And all those other examples is the same thing.
Same thing.
There was just
so they're providing it here in italics. This is according to Scrivener, so that it correlates with the cross reference. Okay? Now, later on, this thing about Goliath is going to come up again later on when we talk about King James only arguments regarding italics. Okay? For the Geneva Bible, the Bishop's Bible, at least, possibly more, when you went to 2 Samuel 21:19, they had a cross reference in the margin that told the reader to go here. So what the King James translators do is they just take that marginal cross reference and they just use the italics to assert the phrase directly into the text and put it in italics. Okay. So there's a couple more here, but I think we get the point, right? Okay. So Scrivener concludes his discussion. I'm on top of page 3. I did skip like the last one or two just for the sake of time, okay? Top page 3. Scrivener concludes his discussion of class 1 with the following statement. Now, before we read this, I want to say, in the previous lesson 258, I have the whole thing. I have the whole quote. This time I'm just giving you sort of the last little bit here, just to not repeat everything and be too overly redundant here. So here's what he said on page 65 regarding this case. He says, this is the simplest case, for the words supplied in italics are doubtless lost in one ancient text while they were preserved in the other. Okay? Now, that's his opinion. Okay? So what he's saying, if we go to the one about Goliath, let's just go to the one about Goliath. What he's saying is that the corresponding Hebrew words that are the brother of here in 1 Chronicles 20, verse 5, are preserved in that verse, but they somehow were lost in this verse. That's what Scrivener is saying, okay? And this is where then a lot of King James advocates get really prickly about Scrivener, because I'm not sure, that's his opinion, right? That's his judgment. He can't necessarily prove that, okay? So look at my point there then on page 3. This is Scrivener's opinion. One can observe the accuracy of Scrivener's classification of class 1 italics without agreeing with his interpretation. So he's clearly making some observations here that seem to be legitimate observations. But then he gives an interpretation to explain those observations, and his interpretation is, well, the one passage doesn't preserve the wording, the other passage does. Like God somehow can preserve it in one verse but not in the other. Okay? It seems to me that the simplest explanation is just to acknowledge that the King James translators are aware of the fact in the instances there with Goliath that if they don't supply the words in italics there, everyone knows who killed Goliath. Everyone knows in other places that David kills who? But if you leave this out, it would say, a Bethlehemite slew Goliath. Whatever this guy is, Elhanan. And so you would have then a problem with other verses, right? And so Scrivener's interpretation is to say that, well, what the God preserved the language in the one verse, but not in the other verse. Not sure I agree with that. I think what's the more plausible explanation is that the translators are just providing the words in italics to avoid confusion for the reader about who slayed Goliath. Okay? All right. Anybody want to comment or question on that before we move on? No?
Well, without the italics, some of it doesn't make sense. And
right.
Then you have the contradiction with who slew Goliath.
So you have issues of sensibility in English, sensible sentence.
Right.
And then you also have issues related to the fact that are there other clear verses in the Bible that tell you that David killed Goliath?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know exactly what's going on, particularly with the Hebrew, or if the Hebrews would have known. But I don't know that I necessarily agree with Scrivener's interpretation of why this happened. I think his observations about what's going on with these different parallel verses seem to be plausible to me. His interpretation is where I would get a little bit sideways, maybe, with Scrivener. Anyone else want to comment on that before we move on to class two?
What's the evidence that other guy killed Goliath?
There isn't any.
That's what I was thinking. I mean, it was told that he hit him with a stone and then cut his head off with his own sword. So.
Right. And that's clearly stated in other passages.
Yeah.
So, and even in other Bibles, they had marginal notes specifically directing the reader to go back and look at the other parallel spot in 2 Chronicles, or 1 Chronicles, excuse me. Okay. Yeah.
So I'm just curious, class one, class two, etc. Is that kind of like category?
Yeah.
Okay.
Category one, category two, category three.
Okay.
But the reason I'm using the word class, Amy, is if you go back up to the quote, go back to page, what page is this? Go back to page one. The second open bullet point.
And was in categories.
Yes, he says, Vance says he identified six reasons why. Okay. And then somewhere along the line, somebody was using the word class to illustrate this.
Okay.
Can't remember now off the top of my head where I saw that, but it's a category, it's a class.
Right, okay.
It's what I'm getting at. Okay. All right, anybody else on class one? Did you have anything, Mike?
No.
Okay, class two then. Scrivener's second class is described as follows, quote, when the extreme compactness of the Hebrew language produces a form of expression intelligible enough to those who are well versed in it, yet hardly capable of being transformed into a modern tongue. So let's read that again. Quoting from page 65, when the extreme compactness of the Hebrew language produces a form of expression intelligible enough to those who are well versed in it. So stop there. So in other words, people who knew Hebrew, would they be able to understand what was being said? Okay? So let's read that again. When the extreme compactness of the Hebrew language produced a form of expression intelligible enough for those who are well versed in it, but watch, yet hardly capable of being transformed into a modern one. So in other words, put another way, you could say that or summarize that, it seems to me, as follows. You guys tell me if you agree. These are technicalities where those people who know Hebrew or would be able to get it, but to state in English what the compactness or tightness of the Hebrew is saying is going to require some additional what?
Words.
That's the way I understand what he's saying there. Does anybody see that different? Okay. So Scrivener used an example from the text of the English Bible, 1883, by Bishop Thomas Turton to illustrate his point. Okay, so let's look here. One or two of Bishop Turton's, and he's referring to his book on the text, pages 50 and 51, examples will illustrate our meaning, okay? So notice this is Genesis 12:9, okay? So everybody look up Genesis 12:9. 13:9, yes. Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me, if the left hand, then I will go to the right, or if the right hand, then I will go to the left. So that would be the verse without any what? Italics. Okay, so everybody grab your Bible. And where are we at here again? Genesis 13:9. If you look at Genesis 13:9, notice the italicization. And we'll see this a little bit more directly here in a second. But notice if you just look at it, there's a bunch of words in that verse that are inserted in italics. Okay? So take your eyes off that for a minute, put your eyes up here. So what Scrivener is saying by quoting this Turton guy is this is what the verse would read. This is how the verse would read in English without what? Italics. And is it very difficult? I'm going to read it out loud again. Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if the right hand, then I will go to the left. That sounds a little bit like English gibberish. In other words, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, right? Then he's got another one here from Exodus, 14:20. And it was a cloud and darkness, but it gave light by night. Those are quote Scrivener from page 65. He's quoting Turton's example. So let's keep going with this. We'll come back to the italics in a minute. So the two examples cited by Scrivener from Genesis 13:9 and Exodus 14:20 are being used in the context of Bishop Turton of what a woodenly literal reading of the Hebrew text would sound like in English. So that's the point. The reason they're giving these examples is they're trying to say, if you were absolutely literal to what the Hebrew was saying, this is the way that it would read. And that doesn't make for wholly intelligible what? English. Okay? So again, right here. The two examples cited by Scrivener from Genesis 13:9 and Exodus 14:20 are being used in the context by Bishop Turton of what a woodenly literal reading of the Hebrew text would sound like in English. Quote, now I'm quoting from Turton, page 49. I shall now quote a few instances of text in none of which can the meaning be expressed in English without words in addition to those words which the Hebrew affords. While in some of them great care must be requisite to ascertain and unfold the signification of the original. Although anxious not to extend this essay beyond due limits, I shall venture occasionally to subjoin to the cited text a few illustrative remarks. When the reader's attention is thus directed to the structure of the Hebrew language, he will be surprised to find how much that we require to be expressed in words might be safely left to the imaginations of men in the Eastern religions of the world. So what's he saying? He's saying that in Hebrew, this stuff would have made what? Sense to the people who read and understood Hebrew. But now when you try to translate that out of the donor language into the receptor language, in this case being English, do you have to provide other words to provide context and scaffolding so that the English reader can what? Understand what's going on, okay? Scrivener goes on to state the following and provide examples of how he handled the two verses in question in his Cambridge Paragraph Bible from 1873, okay? Everyone must feel that something is wanting to render these verses
perspicuous.
The latter, indeed, we shall hardly understand without looking closely to the context. It seems quite right, therefore, that supplementary words should be inserted in such places and equally fit that they should be indicated by some contrivance, right? Which may show that they form no part of the original Hebrew, which is a fancy English way of saying, you need the words. It makes sense to put them in a different font so that everybody knows that the translators are doing what?
Adding
the words. Okay? So the following then are screenshots of how Genesis 13:9 appeared in the standard. This is a typo here, Mike. This should say the standard 1769 Blaney text. In the case of Genesis 13:9, Bishop Turton points out the italics is unevenly marked in various editions of the AV. Okay, so let's look here. So here we have Genesis 13:9. Okay? Now, I want to compare this with what you guys have. So I have my Bible open in Genesis 13:9, right? So is in italics, right?
Yes.
Okay? Yep. Is not the whole land before thee separate? They separate thyself. Okay? I pray thee from me. Now watch. If thou wilt take, that is now in what?
Italics.
The left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart, thou depart is in what? Italics. To the right hand, then I will go to the left. So in other words, is adding these italicized words important for the English reader to understand this Hebrew text? Everybody following this? Okay, now let's look though now at 16:11. So I want you to see these side by side. Notice, here's the 16:11. Thou is not in what? Italics. Is thou in italics here? Thou is not in italics in the 16:11. Is thou in italics here? Yes. Okay. So that's Turton's point, right? Is there uneven italicization now in this verse, Genesis 13:9, between the 16:11 and the standard 1769 text? Okay. Amy?
The first word is.
And this is not in italics at all. Okay? It is here. It's not here. Okay? So when we see this statement here by Turton, I'm talking about this one right here in this sentence. In the case of Genesis 13:9, Bishop Turton points out that the italics is unevenly marked in various editions of the AB. So he points out that the standard 1769 text has different italicization than what's in the 1611. Okay? Any questions so far? Scrivener expands class 2 with the, I'm on the bottom of page 4. Scrivener expands class 2 with the following additional examples. Once again, I've annotated this quote with screenshots of the relevant examples. To this class, we may conveniently, right, refer to the numerous cases wherein what grammarians call the apodos. Now, that's a technical, that should be in italics, by the way, Mike. The word apodos, we need to switch to italics because it's that way in Scrivener. That is the consequence resulting from a supposed act or condition. That's a technical grammar word referring to the consequent of something. Okay? Is rather implied than stated. So you have an applied consequent. It's implied, but it's not what? Stated. Okay? Yet the English requires something to be expressed more or less fully, such as such are the following texts. Okay? So notice the first one here. And so we've got Genesis 30, verse 27. Look at Genesis 30, verse 27. And Laban said unto him, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry for is put in what?
Italics.
I need to underline this too. Tarry for is put in italics. So in other words, if he's found favor in his eyes, what's the consequence of that? What's he supposed to do?
Wait,
hang around, tarry, right? So that the translators insert that. Is everybody following that? So in the Hebrew, would it have been clear to the Hebrew reader that that's what should have happened? But it's not going to be clear to the English reader, so do the translators insert the italicized words? Okay. 2 Chronicles 2:3. 2 Chronicles 2:3. And Solomon sent to Huram, the king of Tyre, saying, as thou didst deal with David my father, and didst send him cedars to build him a house to dwell therein, notice the italics, even so do with me. So in other words, it's implied in the Hebrew that this would be the response, or this would be the consequent of the action, but it's not immediately clear to somebody in English, so do the translators provide the phrase? Okay? Is everybody understanding this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Daniel 3, verse 15 is another one. Now, if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made. Italics, well. So in other words, when they hear all that music, what are they supposed to do? According to Nebuchadnezzar. Fall down and worship. And if that's the response, are they giving the correct answer that he wants?
Yes.
So the translators insert the word well in English to make that clear to the English reader.
Yeah.
Okay. Luke 13, verse 9. And if it bear fruit, well. And if not, then after that thou shalt cut it down. Okay? So here's an example from Greek where it would be obvious if it bears fruit. Do you have to mess with it?
No.
No, it's supposed to what?
Bear fruit.
Bear fruit. Okay, so they insert that in, they insert well in there so that the English reader what? Understands. So, page 6. Occasionally, our translators with happy boldness have suppressed the apodos entirely, as in the original. And he gives some examples here. Exodus 32, verse 32, and Luke chapter 19, verse 42. And in some few passages, the seeming necessity for such insertion arises from a misunderstanding, either of the sense or the construction, such is probably the case in Nehemiah 4:12, and questionably so in Matthew 15, verse 6, and Mark chapter 7, verse 1. So what is the second class or category that Scrivener is identifying? Places where the Hebrew is compact, and it would not make sense to the English reader unless the words are what? Italicized and added to the English text. And then he specifically identifies these places where you have this situation where you have a statement, and then there's an implied consequence. The Hebrew would be pretty clear what it was, but in English, they need to insert it to make it complete in English. Okay? So, that's two classes. Any questions?
Just to make a statement that these translators, they had to know their Hebrew.
They had to know their Hebrew. They had to know.
When they were reading the Hebrew, they knew. So that's how they knew to
correct
those words.
Correct.
That had to be. To know Hebrew, you had that had to be passed down. I mean,
no, to some degree, but you the only people that knew Hebrew really are like highly trained university grammarians.
It couldn't be too many.
And there's probably not too many of them, particularly at this point in history in the early 17th century, which is why, which is another reason why this translation is so remarkable, because you have arguably the best trained linguist, arguably in world history ever, working on this Bible. Okay.
There were a lot more people that knew Hebrew back then than there is now.
And that's probably true as well.
Yeah. How many people know Hebrew today? Yeah.
Well, even the guys that go to seminary and they take Hebrew, I would question if they leave with anything more than maybe a fourth grade Hebrew reading level. Okay, I don't think their Hebrew skills are anywhere, and that's a generalized statement. There might be some who are better than that, I'm sure there are, but generally speaking, the average seminarian is maybe familiar with Hebrew at maybe a fourth grade level. A lot of these translators were reading Hebrew when they were in their teens. But again, I've said this before, what else do you have to do? If you're a smart kid from an upper middle class, even if there was even a middle class, but if you're a smart child of a family of means, what is there for you to do other than to go to school and learn languages and study?
Well, they had to have stuff to study from.
So well, that's why it's at the universities and stuff like that. But the average Englishman is, there's no way that they could have done what these guys did.
How old is that stuff? That stuff's got to be from...
Well, by this point, though, you got to remember that a lot of what had been hand-preserved had started to be converted to printing. So things that had existed throughout much of world history only in manuscript form were in the process of being flipped into printed text. which is a massive advantage to any of these guys. The printing press is invented in like 1456, 53-ish, somewhere in there off the top of my head, if my memory's right. So that means you've had 150 years between when the printing press is invented in the year 1600 to convert a lot of handwritten manuscripts into published texts. Not saying that they still didn't use some handwritten stuff. I'm sure they did, but the situation was a lot different then than it is now. And I think Mike is also right. I think you probably, by percent of population, there were probably more people who knew Hebrew then than there are now. Mm-hmm. All right? Anybody else?
How close is that to Latin?
Nah, it's...
No.
Hebrew's a lot different than Latin. Okay. I wouldn't purport to know all the reasons why. I'm just telling you what I've heard and read. All right. Anything else before I go to class three? Maybe if we could get through class three today, then we could go 4, 5, 6 next Sunday. Okay. Class three. Scrivener describes the third class of his italics as follows. Quote, just as little objection will probably be urged, against the custom of our translators in italicizing words supplied to clear up the use of the grammatical figure known as the zoomgma. Sure, we'll go with it. Whereby in the Hebrew, no less than in the Greek and Latin languages, an expression which strictly belongs to but one member of a sentence with some violation of strict propriety is made to do duty in another. So, let me tell you how I understand this in layman's terms. Sometimes are there words that pull a double duty for the beginning of something and the end of something. So, read that last part again. An expression which strictly belongs to but one member of a sentence. So, it's in the first part of the sentence, strictly, with some violation of strict propriety, is made to do duty where? In another. So to me, he's talking about a word that is technically in maybe the first clause of a sentence, but that word in the first clause, does it also influence or have bearing on how you would understand the second clause or the second part of the sentence?
That's kind of about sentence structure.
Yeah. So, this class is illustrated by the following examples. Yet again, I've annotated this quote to include screenshots of the examples, okay? So let's look at this one from Genesis chapter 4, verse 20, and I think you'll see what we're talking about here, okay? Now notice, and Adah bare Jabal, which was the father of such as dwell in tents, and, now here's italics, of such as have what? Now notice, see this here, of such, at the beginning, is this in italics?
No.
No. Do we have a similar added italicization here? Mm-hmm. Okay, so think through what we just read Scrivener saying, right? So do we have a phrase here that's not in italics in the first clause or the first part of the verse that seems to be also pulling double duty for the end of the verse? And so what have the translators done here? Have they inserted similar language to what's not in italics in the same verse?
Yep.
Is everybody following that? Okay. Exodus 3:16. Go and gather ye the elders together and say unto them, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac and of Jacob, appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen that which is done to you in Egypt. Okay? Now this one isn't as clear, but do they insert the word seen? Okay? Now let's back up through the verse. So this first part is him gathering the elders of Israel and say unto them, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, notice, appeared unto me saying, I have surely visited you. So here, notice, so did God see and visit them here in this clause that's not in italics?
Yes. Yeah.
So then what do they insert here? Scene. So let's go back to Scrivener's language. I'm going to read it again. I'm nowhere near on the right page. What did he say? He said, an expression which strictly belongs to but one member of a sentence with some violation of strict propriety is made to do duty where? In another, and he said when that happens, the translators resolved it by putting the words into what? Italics. Okay? Exodus, what page is this? Page 7. Let me get caught up here. Exodus 20:18. All the people saw the thunderings and lightnings and noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. Here, the order of the clauses renders it impossible to supply any single word which would not increase the awkwardness of the sentence. The passage is accordingly left as it stands in the original. Not so the sharper language of the parallel place. Okay? So now we're going to have another example of a parallelism. Okay, so the one in Exodus, he says that there's nowhere for them to add anything that's going to improve it. Okay, but then if you go to Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 12, and the Lord spake unto you in the midst of the fire, and ye heard the voice of the words, but saw no similitude, only ye heard a voice. Okay, so they don't see anything. See right here, ye heard the voice of the words. They saw no similitude, but so they don't see anything, but only they what? They hear a voice, right? So notice, ye heard a voice corresponds with this, which is in the verse where they hear what? The voice. So they added here at the end. It's pulling double duty for the structure of the whole sentence, but it makes the English make more what? Sense. Okay. 2 Kings 11:12. Notice, and he brought forth the king's son and put the crown upon him and gave him the testimony. And they made him king and anointed him. Okay? So he says, Scrivener actually says about this one, insert gave him before the testimony. So they insert it there because so they brought forth the king's son and put a crown upon him and gave him the testimony, and they made more unsure about exactly why Scrivener's marking that one, but apparently he feels that it fits with the category. Okay, Luke 1, yeah.
I think the last two examples here, if you take out the italics, let's go back to the
which one?
The Deuteronomy, what is that?
4:12. Yep.
You start at, but saw no similitude, only a voice. If you take the italics out there, you can't see a voice.
Yeah.
And then in the next one, and they put the crown upon him and the testimony. You think they're taking the testimony and, going like that.
Right. So.
They put it on. They didn't put it on.
They gave.
The crown.
So yeah, exactly. So your point there, Eli, is that if you read these verses without the italics, they'd be weird.
You think the actions that the people are doing are super wacky?
Yeah, good observation. Thanks. Luke 1:64. Okay. Luke 1:64. And his mouth was opened immediately, and his tongue loosed, and he spake and praised God. Okay. Now. In the passage, in the context of this passage, Zacharias is struck dumb, meaning he can't what?
Speak.
He can't speak, right? So let's do Eli's little exercise on this verse and read it without the italics. And his mouth was opened immediately, and his tongue, and he spake and praised God.
His tongue's opened.
His tongue's opened? No. In the context, to say his tongue was loosed makes more sense, because we know that Zacharias didn't believe God, and as a result was he struck dumb. Okay? Right. And then there's one more here, 1 Corinthians 14:34. Notice what it says, let your women keep silence in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but they are commanded to be under obedience. So if you read it without it, let your women keep silent in the churches, for it is not permitted unto them to speak, but to be under obedience, as also saith the law. Adding this makes it more clear what's going on. Okay, and by the way, just in case anyone's wondering, I think the context of this statement is women speaking in tongues in the church. It's not a command that a woman can never open her mouth in a church. Okay, there's a context related to a specific thing going on in 1 Corinthians 14. Okay, but that's the end of class 3. Okay, so let's just, everybody go quickly to the last page so we can... Everybody go to page 16. Let's just review these quick. So I'm going to subdivide these notes this week, and we'll get the last three classes next week. And hopefully I'll have the tech fixed as well. So in summation, Scribner identified the following six classes in the use of italics. We've only talked about three of them so far. Class one. When words quite or nearly necessary to complete the sense of the sacred writers have been introduced into the text from parallel places of Scripture. So we've talked about that. Number two, when the extreme compactness of the Hebrew language produces a form of expression intelligible enough to those who are well versed in it, yet hardly capable of being transformed into modern language. So that's the second thing. Third, just as little objection will probably be urged against the custom of our translators in italicizing words supplied to clear up the use of grammatical figure known as zeugma, whereby in Hebrew, no less than in Greek and Latin languages, an expression which strictly belongs to but one member of a sentence with some violation of strict propriety is made to do duty in another. And we've seen that thirdly here as another example. Okay, so far we've looked at three of Scrivener's six classes for the use of italics. And again, let me say, as far as observing Scribner's classes, a lot of what he says makes sense to me. Some of his interpretations of why he thinks some of this, I would reserve the right to say that I'm not sure I think he's right or that I don't agree with him. Okay? So, that being said, we are almost at time. Does anybody have any comments or questions about the first three classes?
Three is similar to two, except two is different. Verses in that, the three is just in the same verse.
Yes.
It's like a parallel place, but in the same verse.
It's where the word would...
Instead of this book and this verse and this book and this verse, it's
right.
A verse, but...
It's within the same verse.
Yeah.
So.
It's similar.
All right, anybody else with a comment or question?
I have the text of his book here. And the sentence previous to class one, it says, the cases in which the italic character has been employed by the translators of our authorized Bible may probably be brought under the following heads. And then he just has one in parentheses. So heads, headings, categories, it's
classes,
all of them.
Classification.
Something I read, and I don't remember what, specifically said six classes. That's where I got that from. I don't remember what the source was that said that. But all that to me means the same thing. So, all right. With all that being said, I appreciate everybody's attention. And hopefully we'll be here next Sunday, and hopefully everything will work correctly. All right. Appreciate everyone's attention.